And I am just so grateful for what you have done, Rock, to help this be a good show. And you're listening to KBOO on 90.7 FM and other frequencies in Cascadia, and on KBOO.FM, going out to all the ships at sea.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
Well, good morning. This is Fight the Empire. My name is Pierre Fogering, and my guest today is Robert Perry, who is the founder and publisher of Consortium News, veteran journalist, author of many books. Most recent book is America's Stolen Narrative. Also, he wrote a book called Trick or Treason, which deserves to be read, reread, and reread. Anyway, Robert Perry, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you.
Well, this Russiagate wagon keeps bumping along. Wheels keep coming off, but the wagon keeps rolling on. What's going on?
Well, you know, there's obviously a lot of momentum behind a story, even if it's not all that it's cracked up to be. And this is one that that has been seized on by the mainstream media and by much of the Democratic establishment, and some, and number of Republicans too, who have their own interests, both in further increasing the military budget, and in also limiting what President Trump might do that goes outside what they would consider the proper frame of handling foreign affairs. So there was a lot of momentum behind trying to blame the Russians for Hillary Clinton's defeat, and many Democrats seized on it opportunistically because they wanted to see, they thought maybe Trump could be thrown out of office or maybe something could happen, and they were just so angry about his defeating Hillary Clinton that they just wanted to lash out. And so this whole thing has kind of gained an unstoppable momentum, not as much because of the merits. There are some serious evidentiary problems throughout this thing, and a lack of proportionality, but because it serves other purposes. Either if you want to have a bigger military budget, this is great because now you can say Russia's this huge enemy we have to fight and stop. If you want to try to cut Trump down to size, it serves that purpose. But that really isn't what journalism ought to be about. It should be about trying to assess the facts, get the evidence, look at the evidence, and make judgments based on the evidence in a fair, even-handed way, regardless of how you feel about the targets of these investigations.
You think maybe there's an element of shame here, that Americans are so ashamed of Donald Trump, at least some Americans are, they're so ashamed of Trump that they can't believe that our political system elevated this guy. So sort of the devil made us do it defense here or something. Anything to that?
There's some logic to that, I think. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, in some ways, Trump is sort of what the American democratic process has now sunk to and produced. I mean, you could look at it that way. And maybe we should. Maybe we should look at this and say, we've allowed our democratic process to be so trivialized, so soiled by money and by this demagoguery that we seem to tolerate and reward, that Trump is sort of the culmination of this. It's sort of the result of how recklessly the American body politic in general has approached governance. And this, you know, I would trace a lot of this back to you know, my work when I was with the AP and Newsweek back in the 1980s, when we saw the Reagan administration come in and start to regularly, routinely play games with words and with foreign events to try to, what they said, kick the Vietnam syndrome. They wanted to get past that, the skepticism that Vietnam produced among the American people. I think a healthy skepticism about what the government was saying and doing. And the Reagan folks saw that as a strategic threat, so they went about, they sort of set about to how you change that. How do you get the American people back on board? And mostly you do it by manipulating them, by getting them to be fearful, getting them to be angry, and all the rest of it. And so that we've now seen sort of come forward, and as well as the use of more and more deceptive politics, lying in a bipartisan way throughout the system, the exaggeration of foreign threats, which has become common, whether it was Iraq or Iran or Cuba or, you know, or Russia now.
Or Grenada.
So we went, or back then it was like even Grenada, this little tiny island that produced nutmeg, was somehow going to be taking over the hemisphere. So you had this loss of rationality, loss of any perspective that the Reagan people were very good at creating, and others, and it's come forward. It didn't stop then, and obviously it's continued to expand. And you throw that in with all the money in politics and how we've used negative commercials to exaggerate the flaws of some target running for an office somewhere, then the American public has become disconnected from the real world. And that has allowed much of this what you might call Trumpism to flourish. But instead of facing all that, instead of saying, and also facing the failures of the Clinton campaign, how she had she really bungled the campaign in so many different ways, and the Democrats too failed to enunciate a clear reason to even vote for her. It was her turn, apparently, with what they thought of as a slogan. That's why Trump won. The Democrats had stopped messaging, really, in a serious way. The working class, and particularly the white working class, saw very little reason to vote for the Democrats, even though the Democrats over historically had been a great ally of the white working class and the black working class and the brown working class. But they had lost that messaging. And so Trump exploited that. But instead of saying, okay, we all have to look at the mirror, we all, as Americans, we have to look in the mirror, as the Democratic Party has to look in the mirror and see the real flaws and address them, it became much easier to simply say, oh, the Russians did it, which may be absurd, but it certainly has become what, if you look at what's happening on Capitol Hill these days and across Washington, the mainstream press, it's all we seem to talk about, or at least one of the things we talk about the most.
Well, then when the Russians were, apparently, when they're accused of putting out stories, not even stories that they wrote themselves, but American, you know, journalist products, you know, pointing out some of these flaws, then the Russians are accused of trying to destabilize our democracy.
Right, and if the American democracy is that weak and fragile, that some of these things that are cited by the U.S. intelligence community as well as by the mainstream press, if it's that fragile, we have another thing to worry about, not the Russians. You know, for instance, when the Director of National Intelligence, Obama's DNI, Clapper, put out this report on January 6th, which has been sort of the basis for a lot of this extraordinary hysteria, it included a long section on RT, the Russian network. And RT is sort of a basic cable network. It's not, you don't see it very much. It's hard to find it in the United States, but some people watch it. You can watch it on the internet. And they have some good shows. They have some responsible people on there. Tom Hartman's on there. Ed Schultz is on there. So you have this. It's sort of an alternative in news source in certain ways. But what that report from January 6th attacked included. This is where sort of this argument about how Russia was trying to destabilize our democracy. RT, they said, sponsored in 2012. Debates among the third-party candidates who had been excluded from the Romney-Obama debates. So because RT allowed these third-party candidates to express their points of view, RT was undermining American democracy. You know, I don't know how even this was in a government report that's been sort of used as sort of the basis for so much of what's happened since. They also went on, this report went on and said RT undermined American democracy by reporting on the Occupy Wall Street movement. That they undermine American democracy by reporting on the dangers of fracking. Now, so what we're talking about is something which has really lost any connection with rationality. If we think that allowing third-party candidates to express their views is somehow an assault on American democracy, we have truly lost our minds. Because I would argue that that the people who are third-party candidates should have every right to express their points of view. I think that's fundamental to American democracy. But not according to this report by the CIA. The CIA finds that to be objectionable.
Well,
so we sort of have gone off on this wild tangent, and now we've said there was all this pressure placed on Facebook to find something which the Congress could say is related to Russian influence. So they searched one time, two times, found nothing. Then Senator Warner, who is a vice chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee and also a leading figure in terms of regulating high tech, himself was a high tech executive at one point, he flies out to Silicon Valley and basically tells them you better find something. So they find this minuscule amount of material which they say is suspected of having links to Russia, $100,000 in ads over 3 years, in 2015, 2016, and 2017. And you have to understand that the annual revenue at Facebook is $27 billion. And that's always sort of left out of these stories which are focused on this $100,000. Now, the other odd thing about this $100,000 is that, according to Facebook, only 44% was before the election in 2016. So that's, I guess you're down to $44,000. And a lot of it didn't relate to the campaign at all. Now, Mark Penn, who was a political strategist for the Clintons, did an op-ed just this past week in the Wall Street Journal, and he went sort of through the math too, and he concluded ultimately that if you're talking about where any of the money that might have mattered, that is money that might have been spent on the so-called battleground states, he put it at around $5,600. So you're down to this minuscule amount, and that's assuming, of course, that these are Russians, that this is some kind of Russian scheme. But the idea that Putin would say, "Gee, let's try to get into Facebook and disrupt the American election by putting in $5,600 worth of ads in some battleground states," is crazy. This was a $2.4 billion campaign between. Mm-hmm. Clinton and Trump, and so you have this, and you had also, of course, billions of more in free media for the debates or for the conventions, etc. So the idea that this minuscule amount of money would have any impact on the American political system is nuts. And we also then from this they found there were 201 accounts on Twitter that were connected to this. But there are, but Twitter has like 328 million monthly users. So, you know, you're, again, mm-hmm. you're talking, so this becomes, this has become a front page story across the American mainstream media, and it's created an hysteria. But the hysteria is simply not backed up by any rational assessment of the evidence.
Well, it's kind of a little sidebar here. I watch RT pretty regularly, and one of their shows is called Crosstalk. It's sort of a three or four-way kind of panel discussion. And I've now and then I've seen Michael O'Hanlon from Brookings on that show.
Well, it's what RT actually does, and I know some people who work there, mm-hmm. you know, Tom Hartman and others, and they have a very wide variety of people that appear. They have people on the right, people on the left, people in the center. I mean, it's much more diverse about getting American opinions, and not at all predictably, than what you would see on CNN or MSNBC or Fox, which are much more narrowly confined in terms of what they'll allow on and who people allow to talk. So I would argue, I would think that most Americans would also agree that the more diversity of opinions you have, the healthier your democracy. Rather than shunting aside people, even credentialed people, people with important things to say, shunting them aside and making them non-people. Obviously, the classic case is how the mainstream press has dealt with Noam Chomsky, a sort of a leftist theoretician at MIT, and who's written a number of very important books, and is probably considered across the world as one of the American leading intellectuals. Yet he's been essentially blackballed from American media, while they have on all these idiot talking heads who repeat the same stuff, who work for some think tank. Many of the think tanks are funded by military contractors, and some of them are funded by foreign governments. And they show up and they spout their stuff, and that's great. On you know, and I'm not against them having their say, but what's happened is that people who have credentials, who are serious people, and have contrary evidence or contrary points of view, are just excluded. But sometimes they do appear at a place like RT, and I would say that shows the health of American democracy, not an assault on American democracy.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of the items that this bandwagon has dug up. I mean, there's tell us about the puppies.
Well, this was in the New York Times, and you know, it's reached the point because as people have gone through some of these Facebook accounts, and there were something like 470 Facebook accounts and pages that have been cited as having a suspected link to Russia, whatever that even means. I'm not even sure what a suspected link to Russia means.
I can ask you about that, yes.
But so it's as vague as you could possibly make it. But so, and by the way, you know, there are about 2 billion monthly users at Facebook. So we're talking about 470 accounts and pages. Now, but it was people have gone through some of this. One of the pages, according to the New York Times, which had gotten some look into this, was about puppies. It was about, had photographs of puppies, and didn't have anything political at all. So the New York Times, of course, you know, was scratching its head, trying to figure out how this must be sinister, since of course we've linked it possibly to Russia, so therefore it must be sinister. And so they had this thing about, you know, maybe the puppies. The page was meant to find Americans who are interested, so then they could slip in some messaging. You know, of course, the Times says we don't know that because we can't see the pages have been removed. But what? You know, but so instead of people saying, hey, maybe you know, maybe we've kind of gone overboard on this thing. Maybe it's not as big a deal as we've made it. Maybe it doesn't deserve to be on the front page and be on the, you know, the crawls on CNN every day. Maybe we should just kind of cool it because we've exaggerated this thing into kind of a McCarthyistic style Red Scare. Instead of that, they keep trying to find something sinister about why would the Russians have a page on Facebook with puppies? You know, and CNN came up with a big thing about Pokemon Go. And
yes,
how,
the Pokemon.
How, you know, there was someone found a link on a home decor site that went to some one of these pages, and the page was about was sort of about offering reward or some kind of Amazon card or gift card if you went to a Pokemon Go site near one of the places where unarmed black people were killed, and if you named your Pokemon after one the victim, you might get it. But then they say, well, there's no evidence that any of this actually happened, that anyone ever entered this contest, that nothing. So, but this was like a big story on CNN. You know, and at some point you might just sort of say, hold it. How does this even make any sense? Now, the overlaying thing is, oh, the Russians are trying to disrupt our democracy by pointing out things that cause tension in America, like puppies. But of course, the original narrative, if you go back to the original Russiagate narrative, it was that Russia was trying to put Trump into the presidency and somehow had sort of seen years and years earlier, 5-6 years ago, how Trump was going to become president of the United States, which, you know, would mean that Putin has the greatest crystal ball on earth, and that somehow they were going to, even though everyone thought Hillary would actually win, they were willing to take this enormous risk of offending her, the likely next president, by taking this foolhardy effort to sort of help Trump get elected. That was sort of the basic original narrative. But that sort of has kind of, you know, begun to sort of collapse under any serious investigation, even about where some of those emails came from that was sort of based on. So then this new narrative was placed in that the Russians were just simply trying to cause discord in the United States with their, you know, $100,000 in Facebook ads, and so forth. And so we've had this quote scandal, which whether there is something to it at some level, maybe some Russians did do some things. The idea that Putin would have set up such an ineffective setup with so little money invested and with, you know, puppies on Facebook pages and some Pokemon Go idea becomes ludicrous. But we can't treat it that way because the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Democratic Party, they've all decided this is serious business. And many Republicans, too, by the way, who have a lot of reasons they'd like us to hate Russia, too. It's not just the Democrats who have become this rabidly anti-Russian group. It's also, of course, the Republicans. The neoconservatives desperately want to get the defense budget up. They want to create a new Cold War, which will justify all kinds of military spending. And the way this ecosystem in Washington works is that if you create more tensions around the world and therefore more spending for the military, that the military contractors then kick back a share of that to the so-called think tanks of Washington, which then hire the neocons, who then create the arguments for more tensions and conflicts and war. That's how it all works. Now, the American people may not benefit from any of this, and certainly not the people that end up in the U.S. military who get sent off to fight these god-awful wars, but that's how it works in Washington, and that's why it makes a huge amount of sense to stir up this kind of animosity, anxiety, hatred, and profit from it. And on top of that, now we had in last December, we had the Congress authorized $160 million to so-called combat Russian disinformation and propaganda. So that meant that all these think tanks and scholarly groups and so forth are competing to get a share of the money. So if you want a share of that money, you've got to play up the whole Russia gate thing. You've got to say, you've got to use your little scholarly group to find something that can support the narrative. In other words, it becomes a self-perpetuating business model.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes forward. And in the media side, I mean, some people on MSNBC and elsewhere have built their careers into much greater lucrative things than they would have been by pushing this. So there's a lot of self-interest that has gone into this, but there's been very little skepticism, very little professional journalistic skepticism applied.
Well, you compared it to the Iraqi war fever back 2003, and this makes me think it is very similar because there's no dissent from this kind of mounting, fever going on. And but where is this going to lead? I mean, is it going to? Do you think this will? Is there a lot of war talk in Washington D.C. these days?
Well, there's a lot of tough guy talk or tough mm-hmm. gal talk in some cases about how we're going to take on the Russians. We're going to arm the Ukrainians to fight the Russians. We're going to even though this Ukrainian military is also involving a lot of neo-Nazis, by the way, which mm-hmm. the Azov Battalion and others, that's also suppressed within the U.S. media. In Kiev, there are these neo-Nazi marches with torches, just like we saw in Charlottesville, but much larger.
Oh, the one just the other night, I believe.
In Charlottesville, it's obviously a news story. When it happens in Kiev, we just don't talk about it
mm-hmm.
because the neo-Nazis played a key role in the whole coup regime back in 2014. So we don't want to talk about that because it goes against the narrative, which is that our guys are always, the white hats, and their guys are the black hats. So we have to pretend otherwise. But yeah, so in Washington, there's a lot of aggressive talk about Russia, a lot of aggressive talk about Iran, a lot of aggressive talk about many of these places because, frankly, that's sort of the bread and butter for much of how Washington works now. I mean, Eisenhower was not wrong when he talked about the military-industrial complex and how it infects pretty much every facet of American life in terms of both politics, the media, just down the line. So sure, I think it's sort of a carelessness about it. If we keep running these tensions up with Russia and keep pushing the Russians, putting troops on their borders, and constantly accusing them of aggression, even though we're the ones with NATO who have put troops right next to their borders. They're not putting troops next to the U.S. border. But we act like this is somehow their fault. They're the aggressors. And that puts everybody on edge. And the danger about nuclear war has always been that things sort of get out of hand. Or maybe someone just makes a mistake. Maybe some kid with a radar screen in front of him misreads something, and before you know it, before people can stop and have time to think, they react, and so what we're talking about is the possible extermination of life on the Earth. I mean, it's not a small thing. I mean, it's as big a thing as you can possibly imagine. Thermonuclear war, as used to say, would like ruin your day, and so this is the game we're playing. And if we're going to play that game, we should at least know the facts and put them into some rational context. We should not exaggerate. We should not sort of play this sort of McCarthyistic fear game. We should not bait anybody who sort of says, hold it, maybe that's not right. We should allow some of those people, onto CNN or onto MSNBC or onto Fox, or we should maybe the New York Times should have some op-eds from people who actually have questions about this or have reasons to doubt it. And there are serious people who have questioned even the fundamental basis of this whole Russiagate matter, which goes back to how did those emails get to WikiLeaks? WikiLeaks, of course, denies the Russians gave them. The Russians deny that they gave them. And people like William Binney, who was like one of the top technical people at the NSA and knows a lot about how these things are, what the U.S. capabilities are in these areas, says that there was no way that this was done as a hack, that it was clearly a local leak that... it wasn't the Russians somehow overseas doing this. Now, you can disagree with Binney, but why isn't Binney allowed to present his evidence?
Mm-hmm.
Why isn't he allowed to be on one of these shows and say, hold it, maybe the whole basis of this is made up or false or a mistake? He's not. We have to believe that this is fact. For a long time, remember there was this that all 17 intelligence agencies agreed.
Oh, right, yes.
And that wasn't true. That was mm-hmm. that was a falsehood. We now know it was a falsehood because even Obama's people admitted it. But that's where we are.
Well, it seems to be no end in sight. The end in sight is kind of a disastrous end. I'm really very, very concerned about that. But our time is up on this show today. We've been talking with Robert Perry, who's the publisher of Consortium News, and really a worthwhile place to get some real facts. And I want to thank you very much for being with us.
OK, Okay, thank you.
This is a story that just keeps rolling on. I'm I'm afraid to see where it's going to lead us. Thank you again very much for Robert Perry. Stay tuned for KBOO, your radio station. Stay tuned for Air Cascadia.
That's right. Air Cascadia is coming up. Also this morning on your Thursday, it is KBOO Portland with Flashpoints at 10:15, Investigative News Radio with Dennis Bernstein. And then at 11, an hour long Between the Covers, Dan Johnson will be talking with author Craig Johnson about the latest book in his Longmire series, the basis for the Netflix show Longmire. KBOO keeps you informed and you can get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member. Coming up next, it's Air Cascadia.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present David Barsamian, Resistance in the Age of Trump, on Sunday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Journalist, author, and activist David Barsamian will be speaking about the broad coalition in opposition to the Trump administration, which includes activists from a range of causes, progressive Democrats, and concerned Republicans. He'll be reflecting on the core issues at stake today and why so many people from such a range of identities and perspectives are challenging the administration. Again, that's KBOO Presents David Barsamian, Resistance in the Age of Trump, on Sunday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.